Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, Mark. I should say I'm fantastic, because that's what you usually are.
That is, you stole my line there, but I am happy to have you back, and as well as Rebecca. Rebecca's there in the room as well. Hi, Rebecca. How are you?
Yes. How are you, Mark? I'm great. Thank you.
Glad to hear your voice again. Well, I know you just got back from IIUSA and have some updates for us, right?
That's right. IIUSA conferences are the places really to get updates, both legislative updates, consular updates, and just generally to know what's going on in the EB5 place.
So you're always there and active with that. Are you members of IIUSA?
Oh, yes. We've been members for many years, but we're more than just members right now. We're on the IIUSA leadership, the President Advisory Council, and I'm also a member of the Public Policy Committee. So we're pretty active.
Okay. And is probably here the public conversations and a lot of the private ones behind the curtains, perhaps.
That's right. That's right.
So what kind of updates can you give us at the recent IIUSA event?
Well, the two updates that we really wanted to focus on this show. One was from Julia Harrison, who's the deputy chief of USCIS, the Immigrant Investor Program Office, which is called the IPO. And I can tell you that rumors are that Ms. Harrison is going to be taking the position of chief shortly. So everybody really took note of all that she had to say. The other person who's always a guest at IIUSA, and everything he says, people wait with bated breath, is none other than the wonderful Charlie Oppenheim. Charlie, we call him the magician as well. He's the director of immigrant visa control for the U.S. Department of State. And he really is the important person over there. He's the one who issues the actual immigrant visas. He knows what's going on with regards to Chinese retrogression and retrogression in all the countries, rather. And he's extremely knowledgeable in all issues relating to the visas.
Okay, so you got to hear from both Julia Harrison and Charlie Oppenheim talk about the EB5 program, you know, what's happening and what may be changing, perhaps what affects them and what may affect the person listening.
Right. Julia Harrison was very interesting. Julia Harrison's comments were very interesting. And the one thing that she did state, which we quoted in a blog piece because we really thought that this particular statement was so apt. She stated that EB5 was, quote unquote, quote, not regular immigration law. It's complicated and different, and we, meaning USCIS, appreciate this. I thought that one sentence said volumes.
Wow, certainly. It's almost an open admission of, well, the importance of the program.
Right, yes. Right, right.
Mark, as Mona was mentioning, that Ms. Harrison did have a lot to say. She did tell us about the lengthy adjudication and why processing times were where they're at.
That is the big deal
exactly.
For most people right now, because processing times are horrendous. They're down to, they're up to 17 or 18 months?
17.2 months.
But that's not for everything.
But for new applications that are going in for regional centers.
Right. But if there's an approved petition, if somebody has an approval, if you're on a project where there is an approved 526, then the processing time is much shorter. And she did acknowledge that they did take this into account.
Yeah. So it's, what was interesting is that Julia said that when they get a new case from a new NCE, which is a new commercial enterprise, so it's a new project that's coming in, it's automatically goes to a team. And so any other applications coming in with that NCE goes to that team. So that team already has the knowledge of the project, which can help with the processing times of applicants coming in thereafter.
Well, how? How does that help?
The team, after reviewing the first application, they will review the same project documents that are to follow. So there's no need to go ahead. You already get deference on that project, meaning that it's already reviewed and it's already especially if it's already approved, that they would give deference to those cases following.
So what Julia was trying to say, that if you can file as many cases as possible within a certain project, then all those cases would be adjudicated together, which would again help alleviate some of the processing times. But she did also mention that USCIS are following what Congress had said, which is mend, not end, by dedicating valuable time to writing up the new policy manual. And unfortunately, that valuable time is being taken away from adjudications.
Yes. And along with, they have new employees coming in. So we have new adjudicators, which is great news because then processing times hopefully will get faster. But they were pushed back because the old adjudicators had to kind of take their time and teach the new adjudicators about the new policies and how to go ahead and, you know, writing RFEs and NOIDs. So they had to take time out to do that. So in order to speed up the process, they actually had to take a step back. So that's a bit of a reason is why the processing times are a little slower as well.
And they did hint on that about a year ago also, mm-hmm. that this is what was going to happen. But they are trying. I will give them this much. They are trying to increase processing times. For example, they are conducting virtual video interviews for I-829 applicants rather than time-consuming travel to different states, etc.
This is actually new.
Yeah.
They don't actually conduct any interviews for I-829s. This is something new that they just started. So as Mona mentioned, they're being conducted virtually rather than an officer traveling to each destination to interview the clients. The client will go into their local field office, the USCIS office, and they will be interviewed from there.
Right, because the local field offices don't normally handle 829 petitions, which is just really the realm of the IPO, mm-hmm. which is the Immigrant Investor Program Office.
Well, Mona, Rebecca, let me ask you this. It sounds like a lot of, I wouldn't say more of the same, but almost like this has happened before in recent history. I know that there was a big slowdown and lag with the EB-5 program a few years back. People were pointing to really long processing times. And what they did is they ramped up the adjudicator counts, and process times really didn't speed up for, well, about a year. And what you said was true. You know, obviously the new adjudicators need to get trained up. The experienced adjudicators need to help with training. But there's also a little bit of what's called Parkinson's Law, where you've got a lot of people put to a task that only few had done before. So they were like digging deeper into these EB-5 cases to really prove that they're adding some value to the government process here. Do you think that that would happen this time around?
Well, I can tell you that previously, when we first started EB-5, going back to like 2005, 2006, you know, it was a handful of offices, maybe 6 to 8 offices in a room in a small corner. Mm-hmm. There were that few people, and processing times in those days were 2 months. Compare that to now, where you have, you know, more than 10,000 applicants. I mean, there's 17,000 petitions currently just being,
yes,
filed. There are so many petitions being filed. But what USCIS are doing, and I believe that this is really why they keep talking about ramping up their staff, etc., is that they have become a lot more sophisticated in dealing with projects. They spend more time dealing with what the actual project documents state. They look at every small details. And with regard to the source of funds, we are even getting information that they are sending people out to drive past businesses to check the businesses there, Googling stuff. They do not accept what is written, mm-hmm. as is now. They are certainly doing a lot more due diligence. They're certainly doing reading into everything that's put there. And that's also very necessary. That's also why they've had to expand their team. And unfortunately, it's just part of the process because EB-5 has become so popular. I can tell you that there are rumors that if there is a President Clinton, then there is a possibility that the project part of EB-5 gets taken over to a different department. So there are rumors of that might happen. And if that is the case, I don't know if we're going to have a slowdown than a speed up, or we might just speed it up altogether. Who knows?
So stay tuned for that.
Right. Yeah, obviously there's a lot of uncertainty there. And I'm sure we'll be covering, you know, that as, you know, the election season comes around, which at the time of this recording is really only a few weeks away. Mm-hmm. You know, there is something that I hear that sounds new, and that's this new policy manual in really drafting out what the EB-5 process is for the adjudicators from the adjudicator's end. Would that information be available outside of USCIS? Could an immigration attorney get a hold of the adjudicator's policy manual and really understand what they're looking for?
Eventually they will, because every time they have anything that they're bringing out, they do give you a notice period and a period for comment. Mm-hmm. For example, there was the I-526 forms and I-829 forms are currently in comment mode because they have added and changed a lot of it. We actually were going to discuss, but we decided against it at this point. We were going to discuss the new I-526 proposals, which are really detailed and long and a lot of unnecessary information on that. And we see that as slowing and hindering the process as opposed to helping it. So we've actually, as being members of the Public Policy Committee, have given all of our comments relating to, you know, what we feel should and shouldn't be there. And then the IAUSA will send the comments. They'll put them all together and send it to USCIS so that USCIS do know what everybody's thinking. So they do have a policy manual. A lot of these things are as advisories. It's not law per se. The only body which can develop laws is Congress.
Okay. Well, thanks for exploring that tangent with me. And it sounds like there's many more tangents that go off of that. So thank you.
Well, other than explaining why processing times are taking so long, Mark, Julia Harrison did provide some other interesting and very important information. One of the issues that she brought up was that the website pages of the USCIS website are being translated into Mandarin, and there's other languages pending, which we find very interesting because I don't think there's mm-hmm. any other part of USCIS's website which is in any other language other than English.
Hmm, interesting.
So this is good news for all our mainland Chinese applicants. So what I also found interesting, Mark, is that when we have a lot of times our clients get frustrated and they want to know what's going on. So you have a 1-800 number, you call USCIS, and of course the officer's there. They always tell you your case is still pending, it's still within adjudication time, but then they give you no more information than that. So what we found interesting is that she said that the adjudicators who will be adjudicating the IA-29 applications, they will be answering these inquiries, which is helpful because then they will have more information and have more of an idea of what's going on with the case rather than your basic answer of it's still pending. I wanted to ask Mona, though, while we're at the conference, another topic came up about soft landing. Mona, what is soft landing?
All right. Well, soft landing has been brought up a lot recently. Soft landing is for investors who are innocent investors who were defrauded. And of course, all of the incident which happened recently with Jay Peake has raised this issue over and over again. There were pleas by a couple of known practitioners who were standing in the audience, and they really asked Julia to say, will the IPO take into account that these investors are really innocent parties and there should be something for them should they find themselves victims of fraud? Whilst we all agree that was the case, it was very interesting that one regional center owner jumped up and said, whilst he does appreciate that, investors who are defrauded should have some kind of recourse, he did not want a soft landing because he thought that it would open up more fraud in the sense that people wouldn't care. They wouldn't care to do due diligence on a project because if there was a fraud, then they would find a soft landing anyway.
Exactly. So it was a good point.
Right?
Yeah, I thought it was a good point. As immigration attorneys, of course, we want to help our clients and make sure that if there is any fraud, that there is recourse and there's a way, you know, a lot of them, it's their hard-earned money and they're looking for an opportunity to come into the U.S. and start a life with their children. So you want that. But at the same time, does that open up more cases, more fraud cases, whereas clients or the developers not really caring to move forward because they know that investors will ultimately get some kind of recourse.
Right. But we need to point out that there are very, very few fraud cases in mm-hmm. comparison to how many projects there are out there. There is a handful of fraud cases and there are 800 mm-hmm. to 1,000 projects out there. And there really is a distinction between, there has to be a distinction between fraud and just a bad project.
Mm-hmm. So as we are finishing up with what Julia Harrison said to us at the IASA conference, there was one point I really would like to mention is that about the increase of fees.
Oh, yeah.
We've had that. We've made comments on the fees going up. You know, some of these fees are significant, and we wanted to, she said that they're at the final stages. Comments were already sent in. The USCIS officers are at the final stages of reviewing, and she say after that, it most likely will be pretty much around 30 to 60 days before they implement the new fees.
Well, these are the filing fees,
yes.
Not the minimum
not
amount.
Not the minimum amount.
Right.
Yes, sorry.
But the filing fee increases are significant. They're about, they almost double and triple.
Yeah, especially for the regional center filings. That right now, those are about $6,000 to $7,000, and that's going to increase to about
18,000 to 19,000.
Yeah.
So that's a huge jump.
Yes. So we just wanted to put that out there for those who are thinking about filing, if they should wait or should file quickly, I would say file quickly.
And that's the upfront initial petition to be a regional center, not the annual renewal?
Not the annual renewal, but that is also going to go up mm-hmm. as well.
So yeah, it does mm-hmm. make sense to get in early.
Right, right. Yes, so Julia Harrison was extremely enlightening. It was a great conversation, and she was open to questions. But of course, IHA USA events would not be the same if we didn't have a talk with Charlie Oppenheim. And as I've mentioned before, Charlie Oppenheim is the director of the Immigrant Visa Control for the United States Department of State. This is very, very important or pertinent for people who have had their 526 adjudicated and are waiting now to get their visas to come into the United States. At the event, there were a number of Chinese people who were there who listened to everything Charlie says with their mouth open.
Because, on the brink of their seats.
Yeah. Yeah. And Charlie mentioned, and I really would like to talk about this, Mark, because I really don't understand it at all. But Charlie mentioned Chart B of the Visa Bulletin. Now, Rebecca, who's here today, this is her forte. She totally understands and gets all of this stuff. And she is the person really who's, so it's going to be role reversal here, Rebecca. I'm going to be asking you the questions. So first of all, for people who don't know, mm-hmm. what is a monthly visa bulletin?
The monthly visa bulletin comes out in the middle of each month. So say mid-October, the November visa bulletin will be out. And it tells you the date of filing, your priority date. So let's take a step back. Let's say, what is your priority date? For most people, priority dates are pretty much current. You could go ahead and file for your green card, the visa application, at any time.
I mean, after the 526 is adjudicated.
Yes, exactly. Or in any case, so your I-130 or any other applications that you have. But for this, we'll focus on EB-5. Thereafter, if you have, for instance, like China, mainland China, there is a cutoff date. So we're not yet at retrogression. I know everyone says retrogression and we're told off because it's not really retrogression. The dates are cut off at a certain time and it hasn't gone back in time.
And what does that mean? I'm sorry, but I really just don't understand this. What date are we at now? Let's say I'm a mainland Chinese person.
Mm-hmm.
What date are we at right now?
Okay, so for mainland China, your final application date, which is chart A for November, is March 8th, 2014.
So March 8th, what does that mean? Does that mean my case has to be approved by March 8th, 2014 for me to be able to file for my green card?
So that means actually, not when your case is approved,
oh.
It's when you had filed.
Oh, okay.
So that's your priority date. Meaning that any...
So,
go ahead.
Essentially, those people listening to this show in the future, that's about 2.5 years ago. Someone who's filed 2.5 years ago, right?
Exactly.
But bear in mind that it's taking about 2 years mm-hmm. for petitions to be adjudicated. So what you're saying, Rebecca, is that it really is only a wait of 6 months.
Yeah, for some. Unfortunately, for those who are in approved projects and you've got your approvals within 6 to 8 months, you still have to wait. But yeah, pretty much you're waiting through the adjudication of your I-526.
What about people outside of mainland China from other countries?
Outside of mainland China, you're current. You don't have to worry. You can go ahead and file after you got your I-526 approval. You can go ahead and file to either go through your consular processing in your country or adjustment of status here in the United States.
Okay, so that's chart A. What is all of this furor about chart B?
So chart B came in last year, October of 2015. They brought out chart B, which meant that, okay, if your priority date wasn't current, as it would be in the final action date, which is chart A, you would still be allowed to file your application, meaning that you can get, it takes time to file an application if you have to fill out your DS-260 and get all your documents together.
What is a DS-260?
Your DS-260 is your application that you would file when you are conducting consular processing. So once you get approved, you'll file that form. Or if you're in the United States, you'll file your I-45 for adjustment of status. So this allows you to go ahead and file that application with all the supporting evidence, and pretty much you're in queue. So when your priority date is current, USCIS can go ahead and quickly adjudicate your case and get you on your way to your green card processing. Unfortunately for mainland China, they're not allowed to use Chart B at this time if you're conducting adjustment of status. So you have to use Chart A. Only if you're doing consular processing, only then can you submit your, again, your DS-260 form, pay your fee bill, and submit the supporting documents. But for any of those who are doing adjustment of status, you have to wait for your final action date, which is Chart A.
Wow. Well, I still have to say that I really don't understand how a lot of these things do work, and I'm pretty impressed that you guys do. And Rebecca, while you're there, could you explain, you know, I get asked this all the time, and I'm not sure I'm explaining this correctly. Follow to join, join to follow. What does that mean?
Okay, so what happens there? A lot of times you're dependent. So the principal applicant is the one who's the main applicant, who's on the I-526 application. That's the principal. Your dependents are your wife, your spouse, I should say, and any children under the age of 21 that will be accompanying you. So accompanying means that they will be going through the interview with you, or filing their I-45 with you, or entering the United States within 6 months of you entering. So the principal applicant can enter, receive their green card, and if their dependents enter 6 months, they're accompanying. So you have no issues at that point. Following to join is when you want to join the principal applicant after 6 months. So it kind of helps. There are some spouses who aren't ready yet to come over. Maybe they're winding down their business, and or they're not sure if they're ready to come here to the U.S. and get their green cards. As long as they were married prior to the principal applicant coming into the United States, they can follow to join at any time thereafter. So there's no issues. All you have to do is notify the consulate or file your adjustment form, and you'll get your green card along with your spouse, the principal applicant.
Do you have to be married before you file a petition or during the time?
No. So you don't have to be married before you file the I-526 or at the time you're filing, even filing your DS-260. You can, as long as you're married prior to the main applicant, the principal, coming into the United States and getting his green card. So before he gets that visa to enter the U.S.
Okay, that's really interesting.
For children, though, it's a little different. You have to be careful, because then they potentially could age out. So you don't want your children waiting forever either. So for them, they're more than happy to follow to join as well. They don't have to enter right away, but you do have to be careful, because once they hit that age of 21, they'll no longer be included.
Okay. The other interesting point that Charlie had brought up is the amount of direct EB-5 projects in fiscal year 2016. They increased by over 400% from fiscal year 2015. In total, there were, I believe, 842 EB-5 visas issued to investors in 2016. And in 2015, it was only 156. That's a huge increase, Rebecca.
Oh, yes.
I'm sure the uncertainty caused by the regional center program has caused a surge in the demand for direct filings, which is still overall a small amount, but also we are seeing an increase in pooled investment visas.
Yeah, so just to let our listeners know that the regional center program, this is what all the deadline is about, is for the regional center program. For the direct, there's no issues with as far as the deadline is concerned. So if let's say, I'm just saying a big if, if the program, if they decide to terminate the program in December, which the new date is December 9th, for those who are in direct pool projects or any of those who want to file their own direct entrepreneurial project, they can still go ahead and file. They don't have to worry about that deadline.
Right. It's got nothing to do with the regional center program, mm-hmm. but it's very, 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 very yes. unlikely that the program is not continued.
Exactly.
And Rebecca, we get asked this all the time. For direct petitions, somebody from mainland China or elsewhere, are they in a different category? Can they get through faster if they're through a direct or through a regional center when we get to adjustment stage, not at 526 stage?
Fortunately, no. It makes no difference. On the charts, they do have a different category for those who are in regional centers and for those who are in their direct, but the dates are all the same, so it would not matter.
Okay, because people do ask that a lot. And of course, Charlie did update the figures from the total from all the countries. And no surprises here, but it's just interesting to see, again, still China at the top. 75.5% of all the visas were given to Chinese. But that is down. It's down by at least 6 or 7%, because I do believe it was 80-something last year. And country number two is now Vietnam. That's they came in at 3.36%, which is a far cry from 75.5%, but it just shows that Vietnam is becoming more and more popular.
Yes. So, but I think a lot of times we see is because maybe mainland China, they're getting scared of the cutoff dates, because we're getting a lot of different numbers. How many years do you have to wait? Because visa numbers aren't going as fast as they thought it would go. There was a long period of time where it was just stuck at one date. It wasn't moving forward. So a lot of people are getting nervous that the times, you know, it may take more than 2 years before they can even go ahead and apply to get their visa to enter the U.S.
Right. And Mark, we do have a podcast coming up comparing the United States program with other programs. I know we've done that before with the United Kingdom. But the big competition when you do go out of the U.S. are the European programs, Cyprus and Portugal, and even Australia. So it's interesting to see why and where the numbers are coming from. And overall, we see that the people who are coming to the United States, and the reason why they wait all these years, is because they only want to come to the U.S. Yeah. They don't want to consider any other country.
Yeah. So hopefully, you know, we will see something with the visa numbers, you know, if it's either an increase or a change in how they deal with it. But hopefully we'll see something soon.
Well, I do know that they are working hard on trying to find a solution. There are a number of ways out there right now, the number of ways which have been put out there, I should say, right now, that would perhaps increase the visa numbers. Not increase the numbers per se, but shuffle them around. For example, they can take out the 10,000 visas which are allocated to EB-5 include visas for all dependents. They could take out the dependents like they do for other categories and have 10,000 pure investment visas. If they did that, we would have no retrogression for any country.
Now, is that one of the anticipated changes coming up December 2016?
No. So far, December is talking about EB-5 policy and the actual procedures for EB-5. Visas are separate, but we have a whole committee in IIUSA who are just out there looking to see how we can increase EB-5 visa numbers. And there's been lots of propositions given to the senators who are working on the program, as well as USCIS, on how the numbers could be sort of more flexible. Because there's a lot of unfairness as well. There's wasted visas too.
Yeah.
Charlie brought that up.
Yeah, so there was a good point that Charlie brought up, that a lot of times, especially in mainland China, he said about 15% of the Chinese are either canceling or asking for their dates to be delayed. And he said what happens is then the visas go unused and then they recapture it. It goes back into the visa pool. But for that fiscal year, a lot of those visas are being unused when it could be used for those who actually need it. So I would advise for the mainland China, please keep your interview dates. It's very important. So I wanted to leave our mainland China investors with some hopeful news, especially with the dates. The dates are moving forward in the chart. So for the final action date, as I mentioned before, for November, those who file an application or their I-526 application, whose priority date is prior to March 8, 2014, can file. But for December, Charlie also left us with a date, which is also moving forward again another 2 weeks to March 22nd, 2014. So that's good news. At least it's moving forward. It's not retrogressing.
Right. And also, Mark, the drop in numbers from China could also be because there has been an increase in interest from the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. India has jumped up, as many other countries. And that's for different reasons. We are seeing more people, applicants from India, because EB2 and EB3 are reaching ridiculous timelines, 12 to 14 years for some petitioners on EB2 and EB3s. And also, as time progressed, interest in EB5, the actual program, mm-hmm. the successful projects, news of the successful projects have come out and has been introduced to other parts of the world.
Yeah, as we see the numbers lower for China, it's because we're seeing more and more countries that are being educated in the EB5 program, and more investors are coming from those countries.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for that, Rebecca. You know, it sounds like EB5 is complex. And in fact, USCIS and the Investor Program Office have openly acknowledged that it's complex, but different. But they want to handle this complication with new adjudicators and even a new policy manual, but not by offering a type of soft landing program. And I guess that makes sense because EB5 is a risk, and the way it's written, it has to be a risk. And they don't want to undercut that risk, but they do want to help investors through understanding by knowing when their processing times are occurring and perhaps even offering some of their web pages in Mandarin. So Mona, Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing with us what's happened behind the scenes, what's happening behind the curtains in the EB5 program, especially through your involvement through IIUSA.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.